As we begin, I would love for you just to think about or call to mind about the people in your life that got you here, right? The people who have inspired you, the people who have been a significant figure, or events that happened for you that even led you to either you are already in this profession or you're in a postgraduate program with the clinical or the forensic program. Just love for you to take a moment just to call that to mind. So it's 1992. I'm in the car. I'm being driven to the school by my parents, and my mom and I are going to go in to see the principal. My dad drove us, but he's not willing to get in to see the principal. He's kind of afraid. I'm also a little bit afraid, but I have to because the topic's about me. And the topic's not because about that I'm smart or because I won some kind of prize. It's pretty much because I'm stupid. And going into this office, meeting the principal, and you got to remember, this is in Singapore where I'm originally from. So in Singapore, they kind of divide the high school streaming, at least in my era, into three streams: the gifted, the express, and the normal. So I was in the normal stream. So don't get caught up by the naming. What they really mean by normal stream was it actually means abnormal stream, because in this normal stream, instead of taking 4 years in high school, I have to take 5 years instead, an extra year. So we're going to the principal's office because we have to talk about me and the possibility that I can be upgraded to the express stream. So a bit more context, right? If you know anything about Singapore, we are everything about performance. We want to have the best airport in the world, although it's a bit irrelevant at the moment. We want to be the first to have a F1 night race, and we want to be number one at everything beyond the bedroom. And this has been quite a key thing. In fact, just before the whole COVID thing, when I was visiting back in Singapore, I saw a five-year-old kid with a kindergarten uniform, and it says at the back, "Pride in performance." I said, yeah, that's Singapore. You know, that's how it goes. So I'm there. I'm seated there with my mom, and my mom's, you know, she's really good with people. I'm not. And she sort of warms up very easily to anyone she meets. But the topic was about me, and a negotiation is about to happen. Mrs. Ng sized me up and asked, yes, you know, what's this about? And my mom, you know, sets up the agenda and says, you know, we just want to talk to you about the possibility of moving Daryl to the express stream. And you know, and she says, okay. So Mrs. Ng sort of like asks more questions, and my mom just says, we're wondering whether he could, because he's at the borderline, you know, he's just about to be able to make it there. So Mrs. Ng says, yes, I can help you. And my mom's all grinning now, and I'm sort of like just waiting to see what happens. And she says, well, if you donate to the school building fund. And I was like, is this happening? And I don't know, you know, I grew up in a family of two older sisters, which means I have three mothers. And for the first time in my life, I was decisive. I instinctively said, no, we're not doing that. We'll stick to what is. And my mom's kind of like, you know, trying to calm me down and says, you know, don't worry, we could discuss about this, how much and all of that. And immediately, Mrs. Ng, after hearing my reply, looks at me and sizes me up and looks at my hair. And she says, you know, and your hair is sort of really messy. She said something like that. And I'm thinking, what's got my hair got to do with this? And, you know, she sort of tried to brush it off now and didn't want the whole negotiation to happen. But my mom says something to me at the end of this that had a profound impact that I couldn't understand at that moment. And it was only years later that I started to make sense. And I assure you this is relevant, because the topic that we are going to be talking about are edges and leverages. The edge of what we know, my colleagues and I have been discussing about and been studying about deliberate practice, helping people like yourself and I to be better at what we do, and as well as leverage, which means what are some key things that I hope after today that you can go away to work on and play with. So that's my aim. But there's a real important distinction that I hope we can make right from the get-go before we go any further. So let me just fire up the share screen. And if you guys are seeing the share screen right now, there might be a bit of a blank at the moment. Can you put a thumbs up if you are seeing a share screen? Perfect. So the distinction I want to make with you today is there's a bit of an overlap, but the difference between performing and learning. The learning sciences is really clear that when you overemphasize on performance, you impede any form of deep learning. Right? If you overemphasize on getting the results, so if you see a country, not just Singapore, if you look at South Korea, where it's all about meeting the grade, you actually not only kill joy and sort of dampen any spirits of learning, but it also impedes any form of lifelong learning. As you think about the person that inspired you or events in your life today at the beginning, you know, it has implications because it is not just a one-shot moment. It could be a profound moment, but what we're going to talk about is a perpetual continuous learning pattern that we need to get to. So if school, if supervision, if training is all about just delivering and performing, it can really impede what's really necessary. So take a look at this picture for a second. And if you have a pen, or if you like, you're allowed to whip out your mobile phone and just key in, what emotion do you see in this picture? Right, just look at it for a second. Paul Ekman's facial expression sort of thing, you know, study that for a little bit. Okay, if you got that, write that down. And then write down another five more things as we're going to play with these questions. The first one is the level of alliance is mostly due to one of the following, right? So put down your answer, whether is it the client, the therapist, the fit between the two parties, or client outcomes, which means there's a theory that if clients are getting the benefit that they are showing up for therapy, they are also getting higher alliance. It's kind of like an inversion instead of the other way around. So either the client, the therapist, the fit, or client outcomes. Write that down. Next one. The biggest contributor to outcomes for people who come to therapy, is it the working alliance? Is it the therapist? Is it specific ingredients of the therapist or client factors, meaning things about the client? Put down A, B, or C. Number three, clinical supervision improves our performance as therapists. All right, note that down as well. And then finally, our self-assessment of our effectiveness is usually accurate. All right. True or false? This is now a binary choice. Forgive me, there's actually one more that I've missed out. And the last one is, how much of one of my clients' improvements says about how effective I am? So meaning how well I do with one person says how effective I am as a therapist. All right, note that down. Okay, so let's kind of look at the landscape of psychotherapy before we zoom into those two things about edges and leverages. The first is effectiveness of psychotherapy. Now, it's kind of useful to think about how effective we are in comparison, relative to, not that as a competition, but it gives you contextual information instead of just zooming in very narrowly. And the one concept I'd like to introduce to you today is the term NNTs. Now, you might have heard about numbers needed to treat or NNTs because of the whole pandemic era about, you know, how to measure impact of treatment. But basically NNT means this, the number needed to treat in order for one person to have a successful outcome, right? So how many people do you need to treat in order for the gains to happen? So the lower the number, the better. So if it's one, that means it's super effective, means everybody benefits from it, right? So let's just kind of just sweep through the broad scope and look at what is available out there so you get some context. Aspirin prophylaxis for heart attacks. NNT is 176, meaning you need to treat about 176 person for one person to benefit from that treatment. Nicotine inhalers to stop smoking, that's about 10, right? You need to administer to 10 people in order for a therapeutic gain for one person. Placebo for depression is 7. Active ingredients, not too far, about 6. You know, this leads to a bit about debates on the effectiveness of SSRIs or SNRIs, but that's often another topic that a person like Irvin Kirsch talks a lot about. It doesn't mean that people don't benefit from antidepressants. It's just that we don't quite understand exactly what are the other things that involve in the administration of antidepressants. Anyway, what about psychotherapy, right? If you can, quickly put down the number before we review that, because this will give you some context of where we're going to go. If you haven't already, scribble that down, because the answer is 3, right? 3. If you kind of think, what does this mean? It means that you need three person in order for one person to benefit. That sort of rounds up to what statisticians would call an effect size of 0.8 standard deviation, meaning the average person who's treated compared to the untreated sample, it's about a 0.8 difference in terms of the average, which is good news, right? Which means that what you and I and other people in this mental health profession are doing has got a huge impact on outcomes. And lesser side effects, more ripple on generalized benefits into a person's life. Again, zooming out from a large proportion of the psychotherapy outcomes research that we have over the last 50 plus years by now, that a lion's share of outcomes are due to extraneous or client factors. This means things outside the treatment box. That's about 87%. 87%. Now, treatment effects accounts for about 10 to 13%. It seems small, isn't it, when you look at it that way? However, you got to remember contextually, that's still huge. A 0.8 effect size, that's in statistical terms considered large. But let's look at specifically what are inside the treatment effects. One, the approach, the therapeutic modality that you take accounts for close to 0 to 1%. And pause for a moment and think, why is it that if this accounts for such a small piece of the puzzle, that so much of our emphasis, focus, and higher education zooms into this? Now, UNSW might be the exception here, but most of the time we zoom in too quickly on that space. What are the other pieces that account for treatment effects? Expectations, the ritual of therapy, how it is structured, really important. And how much of the person's belief, both the client and the therapist, accounts for about 4%. Alliance, as you have been taught before, accounts close to about 5 to 8% of the outcomes, which you can tell by now, it's not all distinct, it's all overlap, right? But then, the biggest piece in treatment effects is dependent on you, depending on who the treatment provider is. Who matters more than what is being delivered in the treatment? And stop for a moment and think, what are the implications about this? Because a huge part of the experience of the alliance, in fact, Scott Baldwin, Bruce Wampole have done a study called the Untangling Study. It's a dismantling study where they tried to look at the relationship between alliance and outcome. They found that therapists accounts, and we rarely hear this in social science, 97% of the explanatory power of the alliance. In other words, it depends on who the service provider is. 97% of that is dependent on that. It's not just the fit. There are some therapists who seem to be able to work with a wider range of people that accounts for you know, how much engagement is experienced in the therapy. Isn't that interesting? And I believe there's a cause for hope from what we are finding in the literature right now about the impact of deliberate practice, which we're going to dive in. And, you know, there are more studies to talk about this, but one that was done when we published in 2015, we were examining the impact of deliberate practice and in relationship to therapist outcomes. So this is not just how much people put into deliberate practice and just kind of guess about how effective they are. This is actually based on 5 years worth of outcome data that we found that when therapists have a very focused, structured way of doing deliberate practice, they account for a significant proportion of the differentiation between their performance and the average practitioner. So this, to us, is sort of interesting, but it's nothing new, because in the field of other professional domains, this has been done a long time ago. And K. Anders Ericsson, who unfortunately passed away last year, he has this to say of what deliberate practice is. Deliberate practice is an individualized training activity designed by a teacher or coach, right, to help at certain key aspects to help the person in their refinement, or what Len Vygotsky, the Russian psychologist, would call their zone of proximal development. And to receive maximal feedback, this is Anders again, you have to receive ongoing feedback, and the individual have to continue to monitor their training with full concentration, which is effortful and is limited of its duration on a daily basis. Meaning, it's bloody taxing. It's not something that you could do without interweaving breaks and rests. In fact, top performance, something that we don't really see about top performance, the amount of structured rests, breaks, respite, recovery periods are significant. It really has an impact on learning. And, you know, just as a tribute to Anders Ericsson, you know, we did a podcast episode paying tribute to him. And this is me meeting him in 2010. He said to me something that still warms my heart today. You know, I was just a lowly researcher going back to do my doctorate at that point. And he said to me that, hey, you know, if there's anything that you need, please just drop me a line. And he kept that promise, and we continued to have conversations around this topic. So deliberate practice is not the thing that you do in clinical practice. Make that distinction clear, because it is the stuff that happens outside the therapy box. It's what we do before, it's what we do after, right? That seems to account for that proportion of the therapist's effects. The studies that we have seen as well in Canada, for example, when there's 7 years of implementation, we see this gradual improvement over time. And if you go to the Frontiers blog as well, we talk about individuals that we have worked with that had the payoff and had seen their own outcomes improve over time. You can tell as well, this is not, you know, a one-shot thing. It's something less about intensity, more about consistency. I think it's also important that we make contrast between default practice and deliberate practice, so that this becomes a bit more high fidelity when we see the implications for our work. So default practice is usually something that's designed by a teacher. We follow a course curriculum that's designed for the masses, for the average person. And then we test you. We see what kind of performance you have, to monitor if you are competent, and then we repeat, because practice makes perfect, isn't it? So if we contrast that with deliberate practice starts with figuring out where you are, and then an individualized learning approach is designed, something to help you at your edge. You get not just performance feedback, but you get ongoing learning feedback. So how are you learning? What are some learning objectives that you're working on? How are you getting there? How that relates to your performance as an individual? And it's not just practice makes perfect, because practice makes permanent. it concretizes things that you're doing. Instead, what you want is iterations. You want to be able to refine with the help of somebody who knows your work. So there are four stages to this endeavor. I mean, the first one is level one, the integration of the use of measures, right? That's really critical. Number two, after you have used them, you want to develop a kind of baseline to figure out where you are at. And three, you want to work on things that has leverage on improving your outcomes, because what you need to work on may be very different from what I need to work on, and we need to figure that out. And then, as you can see, number four is to design a learning system that is sustainable, that you can, that continues to feed this like a garden. And then the process goes back to level two again. So take a moment. This has got implications, because all that we have talked about, you know, we sort of sweep through the landscape of psychotherapy, and then we look at what's involved in actually in the deliberate practice stage. Because the pointy end of deliberate practice may look like this. It may look like, okay, I'm sitting down, I'm working about how to improve engaging with clients in a certain way. That's the pointy end of it, right? But the whole foundation is built upon integration of the use of measures, then figuring out your baseline. Once you figure out baseline, then you need to figure out what to work on before obsessing about the how, because the psychotherapy marketplace is kind of inundated with how-tos. We need to slow that breaks down and figure out where is your bleeding edge. And then we zoom in there and we design a garden to grow around that edge. So here I want to point out one thing that we do need to also take note about, which are things related to the way that we are training and the way that we believe about our effectiveness. So when we look at clinical supervision, there are interesting studies, although not enough, but based on what we have so far, clinical supervision accounts for, or rather the differences between supervisors when studied in naturalistic settings accounts for less than 1%. And we thought this was just a single study, right? Because we all feel benefit from supervision, don't we? And in another replication study, they found exactly the same thing. In fact, closer to 0% accounts for client outcomes. And mind you, both of these studies have about 1 to 2 hours per week of individual supervision. On top of that, there's also group supervision. So why is this happening? And we got to ask the question that a researcher, Edward Watkins Jr., would ask. We got to really take a moment to pause and ask, really, what is supervision for? We do really need to answer that question, because is it just about feeling benefit, or actually translating that to the person who's not in the room in clinical supervision, which is for our clients? And he says this. This is Watkins now. If we cannot show that supervision affects patient or client outcomes, then how can we justify continuing supervision? I think that's a very fundamental first principle question to ask. What's it for, right? Even education, what's it for? We do need to have clarity about that before we pursue any further on our efforts, because lots of time, money is spent even on continuing education, licensing in other countries, certifications of different processes. But all these does not make us as better therapists. And one of the things I would argue why is because I think we become a bit too much of an explainaholic. You know, we talk about stuff, we create hypothesis formulations, case conceptualizations that's remote from the actual conversational nature of psychotherapy. And we do need to get a little bit more direct on that. So how do we get more direct on that? Let's talk about these two things. We need to talk about the edges, and we need to talk about the leverages. So the edges are things relating to where are the frontiers as a collective. So zoom out with me like a Google map for a second. Just look at the top view, and these are the things that we do need to see. And then when we go into the edges, when we go into leverages, we will zoom into something more personalized. So the first one, supervision. I think we need to rethink about supervision, because supervision means that we need some clarity on this. We need a binocular vision that gives us depth field perception on where we can go. And I think the two ways that we can think about this is not just coaching for performance on a performing level, you know, usual way that we do clinical supervision. We talk about cases, mostly stuck cases, and then we try to help improve the outcomes on that person, you know, talking behind the client's back about stuff and then going to the therapy room, trying to pass that on into the work. I think that's important, but it's not all. So performance and coaching for development. So what are they? Coaching for performance really is about the micro level, as we've discussed. The focus is on the client, right? We want to help improve the specific outcome of that stuck case. But then on the other lens, we do need to have a macro level as well, which means establishing an ongoing learning and development plan, analyzing the data on the therapist level, and the focus is on the growth edge of the therapist. We do need both. We do need to undulate between these two facets. And there's one course, of course, that we talked about. I think Chien was in this together with Anita as well. For supervisors who want to go through that, the next launch is coming up in the coming weeks as well, that we talk about this more. The other edge is that we do need to think about measuring growth, not competence. This is not just semantics, because if we emphasize about figuring out where we are at, then we want to see where you're going, where you are growing. And it doesn't matter where you're at to begin with, because we do need to start somewhere. But this takes a bit of undoing, because most of us, and if you are students, if you are in an postgrad program, we all feel that anxiety. We want to do well. We all want to perform. But we need to straddle that balance, and teachers need to straddle that balance as well, to emphasize about growth over time, which means that we do need to be allowing ourselves to be altered, to be changed, and sometimes to be stupid even in the process. And one of the hurdles that I see for a lot of not just beginning therapists, actually less so for beginning therapists, but more so for seasoned practitioners, is the biggest stumbling block is actually level one, integrating the use of measures. I think that's really important that we have those foundations there. Then as you go, you can build upon what you've got. And it's not just some kind of evidence-based practice that's you're outsourcing that information out there. You have your own practice-based evidence to reap. Luckily, I've been doing this since 2004. You know, there were moments that my data made me cry and weep and go into periods of depression, but it's also the very thing that helps nourish me and motivates me, because it shows me where I'm going and areas that I can work on. I can't imagine doing without it. Number three, and here we're talking about edges. Let's seek to reduce negative variance and increase positive variance. Reduce negative variance and increase positive variance. What I mean by this, by doing things with measures, the hope is that it can help to iron out your blind spots, to help you see things that you might miss because you're too up close in the process, that you can use this systematically baked into your work to reduce dropouts, deterioration rates, because deterioration rates in therapy are a reality, even if you're super shrink. It ranges from anything from 8 to 10%. Dropout rates can range from 20 to 22%. Dropout meaning they stop coming because they're not reaping gains, not because they are improving. And if you're working with child and adolescent population, the rates are even higher on that. So I would encourage more on that. And by the way, I did not mention about positive variance. This means that we do need to allow therapists to do their thing, their own native wisdom, the things that they already bring into therapy about their lived experience, maybe even their traumas that sort of help them grow their significant experiences, things that have their worldview shaping how they think about life. Bring that into therapy, because these are the things that we need. We don't need an average person. We need you. Finally, the leverages part, figuring out the what to work on before the how, as you heard me talk about this early on. This is quite a big thing, by the way. And, you know, even before the pandemic era, and whilst we were running online trainings as well, web-based workshops, consistently therapists are saying that they don't know what to work on. This is a big thing, which is why, you know, number one on leverage, my hopes is that we think about the 80-20 rule. This is called the Pareto Principle. The 80-20 rule just means you don't want to work on 20% of the things to give you... You don't want to work on 80% of the things to give you 20% of the results. I'm confusing myself right now. You want to work on 20% of the things to reap 80% of the results. Meaning, take the time to figure out where is the growth edge? Because what we really need in that process is leverage. We do need to be able to think about what are some stuff that you need to work on that can actually improve your outcomes. So how do we do this? We have this thing called the Taxonomy of Deliberate Practice Workshop, Taxonomy of Deliberate Practice Activity, sorry, that can help you deconstruct this and to see what are the things that you can work on. And if you want to pull out this resource, it's, you know, there's no catch. Everything's free, freely available. You just go to this link that you see on your screen, darrowchild.com/training-gifts, I believe is with the S. And all the resources are there for you to pull out from there. Number two, right? We're near the home stretch now. Number two is there are three distinctions that we need to make about what you are learning in the process. I see them as, number one, content knowledge, meaning learning about psychopathology, learning about psychotherapy models. I think that's one third of the piece of the puzzle that you can be learning. But we also need to understand what is process knowledge and conditional knowledge. Process knowledge is about how we are engaging that in conversation. And number three, about content knowledge, is about what happens when things change, right? If this, then that, right? But if that change, what do we do? We do need to have some level of flexibility around that space. So this leaves me with the last one, is my final suggestion about leverage for you is developing a centralized personal learning system, or PLS. What I mean by centralized, meaning one place, one single application even, not just a computer, but even an application, one place where you store every single thing that you're learning, not just a folder in your Mac, but one app that you use to consolidate all your learning. Because here you want to grow an extension of your mind. Sometimes this is referred to almost as like a second brain. I don't really see this as a second brain, but it's real extension of you, because you are going to be learning stuff, whether you're seeing clients or if you're attending tutorials and lectures and so on. These things are all dots that you have. So it's great to collect all these dots, but you want to be able to connect these dots as you go. And as you connect these dots, you start to see patterns, learnings that only you can see because of your experience. And you could use any kind of application, right, from as simple as Apple Notes, or I used to use Simple Notes. I now use a software called Obsidian. Obsidian is something I really have fallen in love. I'm usually quite stubborn on changing softwares, but I made the switch a couple of months ago because they allow you to create a kind of neural network. It was pretty cool. You get to see a neural network about how your notes are connecting them as you link the notes with your prior knowledge, because that's how we learn, connecting with your existing knowledge about stuff. So I do highly suggest that that's definitely one area that you can have leverage on. You remember this picture we saw at the beginning? Look at your answer. Look at what you've put down. And I think sometimes we do need to have some context just to step back a little. Some of you might recognize this person. This is the famous tennis player, isn't it? So we're back in my principal's office, and my mom said this to me. My mom said to me in that process, as she's kind of nervously laughed off the whole thing, she whispers into my ear something that I didn't make sense of at that time. She said that maybe you are a late bloomer. And I thought, what the hell does that mean? That sounds like an insult. Late bloomer means I'm stupid. And it was only years later, probably about 6 years ago, actually, when I was listening to a producer who was working with Prince on the famous album Purple Rain. And she said this in an interview about her work with Prince. She said this at the closing of a lecture she was giving. She said, slow progress is real progress. Slow progress is real progress. Because you don't want to be a person who is just what I call a dabbler. It means that you just try this, you try that, you know, and the effects is kind of go, 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 and then you dwindle down. Neither do you want to be a hacker where you're trying to, you know, hack things to kind of improve, but you just go up and up and down, you're not really going anywhere. And you know, you also don't want to be an obsessive, which I was, or maybe I'm still am a bit of an obsessive, where you're just putting all kinds of effort and you're really prying through, but then you burn out really quickly. Instead, I think my mom's advice is really useful. And I don't know if she knew that impact it had on me, or it has on me today at age 43, but to be a late bloomer. A late bloomer is somebody who is going through it in terms of little incremental stages, weaving it up, and slowly, slowly, slowly getting there.